IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hi, Pranay and I are here at Takshashila today with a very special guest, High Commissioner Barry O'Farrell from Australia, who's visiting us in Bangalore. And we thought we should have a conversation on how Australia has been looking at the Indo-Pacific. Now, let me just start with this idea of China being an important trading partner for Australia, underpinning much of Australia's growth and prosperity for well over two decades. And then somewhere in the last 10 to 15 years, things began to change. And we are now at a situation where a countervailing coalition in the form of a quad has been formed between the United States, India, Australia, and Japan. So how did this change take place? You know, can you trace this journey of change in policy, change in popular opinion, change in the political climate in which these changes, these happen?
I think there's no neat answer to it. Australia's been a trading nation since it became a nation and before it became a nation. And we sell products, resources, agriculture and others to various people around the world. I'm old enough to remember when most of our products went to the UK, then the European market. Then we opened up trade with Japan and other parts of Asia, the United States. And of course, as you say, for the last 25 years or so, like much of the rest of the world, we've engaged with China to the extent that China, like so many other countries, has been Australia's number one trading partner. So our view is that, you know, people trade with us because they want to receive the products we have. We don't force people to buy our products. And as I say, I've seen in the course of my life situations where Britain went into the common market and suddenly a market closed and we went around and found another one. So notwithstanding the fact that there are these interruptions to customers and contracts with trading partners, you know, Australia's been fortunate in being able to get through. And I think we're resilient in that sense because we've had situations in the past where markets have closed and we've had to look for new ones. I think the bigger issue, though, is that, you know, for the last 20 years, I think we've seen a change in our neighbourhood where there's been a recognition that countries in the region are going to have to take a bigger role themselves in shaping that that region. That's not a reflection on China and the United States per se, but it reflects that at various times over those 20 years, the relationship between those two countries has altered. And they do set the tone of cooperation or competition within the Indo-Pacific. And I think it's those things that I think have made not just Australia, not just India, but a range of countries look to see what role they can play in shaping our neighbourhood. And I think, you know, whether it's the Quad or whether it's some of the other trilaterals or, in the words of your External Affairs Minister, those plurilateral arrangements that are existing, what people are doing in the region is looking to others who share similar views about democracy, perhaps, about certainly the rule of law and norms that should apply, about the sovereignty of states being able to make decisions and the need to use appropriate international rules and norms to resolve disputes. And I think that's been the factor for driving countries together. And of course, COVID has exacerbated these things because, as we've seen in so many areas, disinformation by actors, misuse of cyber technologies by actors has actually increased over the last couple of years. And that's why, not surprisingly, the Quad, amongst other things, looks at things like maritime security, cyber and counter-terrorism, and why those four countries in particular are seeking to work together to try and combat some of these things.
Australia was the first off the mark on 5G in terms of taking a firm policy position that Chinese investment in 5G is going to be a national security threat. Australia was also, I think, one of the first to come out with laws against political interference directed at China. I mean, the law is not, I mean, the law doesn't make distinction between countries, but I think it was in response to what Chinese Communist Party agents were doing in Australia. Now, that really put Australia in the crosshairs of Beijing. And, you know, there's been pressure on Australia because of that. But let me just take you a step back. Why confront China at all? Because one of the ideas is, why don't you just bandwagon onto the Chinese geopolitical journey and become a, you know, be, so to speak, in China's, and I'm being provocative here because it's the same question when it's directed at me, I'll have a different answer. But why not go with China?
Because we are a sovereign nation that makes decisions through democratic processes that benefit Australia. We are, like Indians, incredibly independent people who want our elected officials to make decisions that are in the best interests of their communities. And so I don't see the 5G decision as taking on China. The 5G decision was a decision that Australia took to ensure that this important emerging set of technologies can be used in a way that enables citizens and can help energise economies and not be used in a way that either puts citizens at risk or is able to be used to control nations. And so we were uncomfortable about having certain countries' companies involved in owning those businesses in Australia. So we took a decision that was in the best interest of Australia, the best interests of our citizens, and I think that's respected by all. But you know, you're also right that Australia, like many other countries, has a Foreign Investment Review Board that reviews foreign investment in its country and from time to time rejects investments from certain countries. It's a country that has also, because we're a multicultural country, introduced foreign influence laws following, regrettably, an incident or incidents involving the Chinese community in Australia. But I have to say, as someone who was in politics for 20 years, that that's only been a more recent injection into the Australian polity before this legislation was introduced. In earlier days, the Australian Chinese community was devoid of those sorts of influences. So Australia, on foreign investment, on foreign influence, on 5G, has made decisions that it believes is in the best interests of its citizens, its country, and has never, to the best of my knowledge, as someone who studied history, ever made a decision to benefit another nation because they were worried about a trading contract.
Right, but are there views in Australia which are politically salient, which run against this, which say that, you know, we should not be taking such a strong position against China, we should probably be a lot more moderate in the way you look at China?
Well, as a vibrant, open democracy, of course, there is a range of views in Australia, and you know, you will not get a consensus on many things because that's the nature of open democracies and thriving civil societies and people that are prepared to express an opinion, which is something I also notice is a great characteristic in this country too. But again, I don't believe we've made decisions to take on any country. We've made decisions to protect or to benefit the future of Australia and its citizens. My foreign minister said at the Quad meeting a week or so ago that the Quad had a positive agenda. And she's absolutely right. It's about doing things that is going to benefit each of the countries involved and their citizens as we move forward. It's not a negative agenda in the way that it's presented, or indeed, I'd say, in the way that you say that decisions on 5G or foreign influence or foreign investment review boards were addressed to China.
Let me just take you on that, right? And I'm going to ask you an unfair question. I know it's unfair, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it. But to what extent is Australia's outreach towards India driven by its relations with China?
Well, I think the best way to answer that is that if you go to the defence area, you know, it proceeds certainly on our side any concerns that existed in relation to China in the region. The defence relationship is probably the deepest and strongest relationship we have with India. We've seen that increase, particularly over the last 6 years, where it's increased fourfold. But I think it gives light to the fact that our engagements, all of them, relate to China. Certainly, engagements over the last 9 months with India, particularly in trying to deal with COVID and learn lessons from each other, and trying to resolve issues around supply chains and the like, are clearly affected by China as well as other neighbours in the region. But again, I don't think the thesis is valid, and I think what we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years is continuing efforts by both sides of politics in Australia winning government to deepen and broaden the relationship with India. And that's about, I think, two things in particular. That more and more Indian citizens have come to Australia to live and opened the eyes of many people to not only the fact that they make great migrants, citizens of our country, industrious, peaceful, law-abiding, who actively engage in the democratic process, but also opened up the eyes of many people to the opportunities that exist in India. And I think the India literacy in Australia is far better today than it was 15 years ago, thanks to what your president calls that living bridge that exists between our countries, the exchange of people between our countries. So I think that the relationship is genuine. It's genuine because we do see interests that we can assist with each other on. We can see ways in which we can work those interests to benefit both of our citizens. And I think that seems to be, and that certainly was underlying the meeting between our two prime ministers in June.
I must mention Peter Varghese's fantastic report. So we teach public policy at Takshashila, and Peter Varghese's report is held up as an example of how well to write that report. That's the kind of report you need to write. You might disagree with some of the things that he says, but the way it's presented, the arguments that are made, and the action items that follow from it, makes it a classic example of writing a report. Pranay, you have some questions to ask.
Yeah, so my question was, what areas do Indian and Australian interests converge, and where do you think they do not?
Well, I think the hardest areas of convergence, although we have had some successes, relates to agriculture, because agriculture in most countries is politically sensitive. And it's probably true that difficulties around agriculture and other issues caused the non-completion of the SICA back in 2016. But recently we've seen the entry into the Australian market of pomegranates, which is a great sign, and we've also seen progress made with the importation of certain agricultural products here. But look, I think if you look at the areas that I start with defence, the strategic, the work that is being done in relation to cyber and critical technologies. The work that's being done, including at the Quad, around critical minerals and rare earths, which support those technologies, the work that's being done collectively in relation to the ecosystem in which those systems can operate, strong and wide cooperation between our countries. We mentioned 5G. I know that at a bureaucratic level, both countries are talking to learn from each other examples in this space, not just in the sensitive space, but more broadly in communications, so that we can learn. It's always important to learn the mistakes from each other so that you don't repeat them. Rare the countries don't make mistakes, but even better when they don't make mistakes, they hit home runs or sixes in cricket parlance, that we can learn from that as well. So I think, across strategic water resources, we've just signed a partnership on water resources. We have a relatively smallish Australian company doing great work in Karnataka at the present time, to improve the efficiency of irrigation. We know that in relation to advanced manufacturing, there is cooperation going on. We've got people here working, or we've got people in Australia working with institutes here in relation to COVID. So the health cooperation is going well. And of course, at the centrepiece of Peter's report was the education piece. And we think the education piece can be rekindled. We believe that there's extra opportunities that have been opened up in the national education policy, which we see as a positive. And of course, we look forward to the return of tourism because India's had the fastest growth rate of tourism to Australia. So, you know, in normal times, or what's going to be classed as normal times in the years ahead, we look to those areas in particular as the areas where we'll see growth.
Just a follow-up to that, both of you mentioned Australia's India Strategy 2035 document, and in that there is a section on Indian states as well, right? And the focus areas that you mentioned, agriculture, education, health, in the Indian federal setup, states are at the forefront of all these areas. So do you see Australian and Indian engagement at the state level happening more going ahead?
Absolutely. And can I tell a Peter Varghese story, which is when I first came to India as the Chief Minister of Australia's largest state, Peter Varghese, who was the High Commissioner, made clear to me that he didn't think that it was the role of the states to come to countries like India to try and attract investment. And I had dinner with Peter before I came to India in February, and he had the grace to say that his views had since changed. That the view that I expressed way back then was that the more people from a country in another country seeking to create linkages, to do business, to grow trade investment and other was good. So I think part of the genius of Peter's report, and I agree that it's an excellent report, is that it not only provides target sectors, but also identifies the states. Why is that important? That's important because for too many businesses in Australia that aren't perhaps Indian literate, they look at India, see a big country, 1.35 billion people, and don't know where to start climbing onto the elephant. Peter's report gives them 10 steps up and gives them 10 steps forward. 10 steps up being the sectors that they should look at, and the 10 steps forward being the states that they should visit in the first place. And I think as someone who in politics received many reports, I've not seen one that has been so practical and, as you say, capable of implementation as Peter's report.
In fact, when Peter was here in Bangalore, we spent 2.5 hours talking about this, and Narayan and I were both there, and we were emphasizing the fact that look at India's states. I think his mind was already made up at that point, but I thought we sort of reinforced the conclusions that he'd already reached by that time. And especially Karnataka and irrigation. I think water management is an important issue for all Indian states going forward. And I think Australia has done a lot, both in terms of technology as well as the policy structures around it, in terms of land rights and water rights and how they are different. They're not tied to each other as they are in India. There are a lot of things which we can learn from Australia in the water management space and in agriculture with limited water resources. And I think collaboration between agricultural universities, between Australian states and Indian states, is something which we should be looking at for a longer period of time.
I think, you know, just as India provides technology services to Australia, I think we can provide services to India across a range of fields to help with the self-reliant mission, if you like, because over the, I think it was November to January period, we sent 500 Merino sheep to, or I think they're actually ewes, to India to help improve the quality of the, they'd be rams actually, to help improve the quality of the flocks in those areas of India that are growing wool. Secondly, of course, we know in the minerals and resource sector that we provide services there, and we've been helping India improve its service levels there. You've mentioned agriculture, and it's not just water, but also, we've got our Australian Council of International Agricultural Research, who's been here for a generation, working with farmers and farm bodies around this country to try and improve some of the techniques. And they actually invented a a machine that could even solve Delhi's air pollution problems if we could encourage farmers in the Punjab to use it. It's a tilling machine that basically does away with the need to burn. So there's lots of things that we can learn from each other. But equally, you know, the future is, I think, space technology, and we're seeing greater cooperation between ISRO and those private sector companies since May that are now involved in space in India, and similar countries, similar companies at home, because of course we have the open spaces that and a few islands that can assist with space missions and give a clear shot and messages up to the skies.
That's interesting. And the other part of technology which I think is worth thinking about is that Australian market is only about 25-30 million people.
There are more 9-year-olds in India than the total population of Australia.
That's right. And if you add about 500 to 600 million people in India who are in an upper income segment, it creates a big market. So if you're trying to develop technology which is 5G, for example, which is non-Chinese, then you need this market which is big enough to bring the unit economics down. And I think that seems to be a very interesting area of collaboration, because the economics makes it possible, right? Because either way, you know, either country by itself might not be able to achieve as much of self-reliance, so to speak. But together, it seems like paradoxical, right? Two countries collaborating to be self-reliant. But it seems to be one of those answers which is out there.
Well, I'm sure my memory is right on this, but I think Ola was the... When Ola left India, the first country it came to was Australia, because we were a smaller market and they could test it in effectively an ecosystem that they knew could be replicated across Europe and the North Americas. And I think it applies across a lot of technology. It can be fintech. I was speaking to the health minister, the central health minister recently. We've seen in this crisis in both our countries advances in medtech, particularly telemedicine and digital health. And we believe, and certainly the minister believes, there's great opportunity for cooperation there. And you know, one of the things I think that I'll be doing throughout my term here is trying to further increase the interactions between research bodies here, whether they're private sector or whether they're state or centre, and similar institutions at home. And we're seeking to do that as well, guys, in relation to the thought sector. We're keen for groups like this to be able to talk to Australian similar organisations, so the exchange of ideas at a conceptual level grows too.
I think that's been a fantastic conversation. We hope to have you more often in Bangalore, and the next time you're here, probably to sample our beers and our spirits, which we are unfortunately not in a position to offer you at this time. So that should be another reason for you to come back.
We're both vibrant, vigorous democracies, but I have now discovered one difference between us is that the Australian electorate would never allow a state or federal government to ban drinking before an election.
So we've got things to learn from each other.
Maybe not. Maybe India's got it right.
That's a good note to end this conversation on. Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.